The 1985 National Religious Broadcasters Convention was held the first week of February at the Sheraton Washington Hotel in the nation's capital. The convention is an important occasion for members of the religious media who come together annually to discuss their ministries, compare technologies, and inspire one another for the coming year. The convention is always exciting, but the events of this year's gathering simply surpassed everyone's greatest expectations. It is doubtful that any other convention could attract both the President and the Vice President of the United States. And even if that could be done, the presence of Senator Edward Kennedy at this gathering would seem highly unlikely. Therefore, it is certainly a tribute and a credit to the increasing influence of the national religious broadcasters to have had all three of these distinguished men present at their convention. Now, we are pleased to present the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, the Vice President of the United States, George Bush, followed by an excellent debate between Senator Edward Kennedy and the Reverend Jerry Falwell. We hope you enjoy these historic speeches.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce the President of the United States.
Thank you very much. You did that. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Brent Gustafson, Dr. Ben Armstrong, and all of you distinguished ladies and gentlemen, it's good to be here. I've been coming to this annual convention since 1982, and it's always been one of the high spots of the year. This year, with the inaugural and the State of the Union and our arms control preparations and our work on reforming the tax system, I had to discipline myself and say no to a few things that I enjoy, but I didn't like or learn to like my decision. So the other day I reversed myself. I was so mad I almost fired myself. I've decided to give myself another chance, and I hope you will too. There is a real and a heartfelt reason why I'm here today. I just sent the budget to the Congress. And I hope that at least in spirit, sort of figuratively, we can all from here on have our hands joined in prayer. The next few days and maybe weeks will probably be dominated in terms of the news by talk of economic matters, budgets and the tax structure and so forth. But I want you to know that as we begin the great work ahead of us, I've been thinking very much about divine providence and turning to our Lord and asking for his guidance. I have found myself, as Abraham Lincoln did once, driven to my knees more than ever because there was no place else to go. But I'm also aware, as never before, that what the polls show is true. In virtually every public survey, there are indications that the importance of spiritual faith has grown stronger among the people of our country. Recent Gallup surveys show 64% of Americans, adults, express a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the church or organized religion. 56% of Americans believe that religion can answer all or most of today's problems. In fact, only 1 in 5 doubts the relevance of religion in the modern world. And we'll get them, too. As a resident of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, I may have a special vantage point from which to judge these things. In December, when I looked north from the White House, I would see the huge menorah celebrating the Passover season in Lafayette Park. And when I looked south from the Truman balcony, I could see the pageant of peace and the creche symbolizing the birth of Christ. Showing the symbols of our beliefs in this way in what is for many of us the holiest time of the year is good. Good for all of us, for Christians and Jews and any others who wish to share the joy of our holidays. The other day I was at the National Prayer Breakfast here in Washington, and I spoke, as so many others did, the central place of faith in our lives, and how belief in something bigger than ourselves is probably a necessary precondition to peace. And I mentioned that after 4 years in this job, I know as never before that we are all God's children, that the clerk, the king, and yes, the communist, were made in his image. And I've often wondered about one individual there, because when I said that, a fellow in the back of the room, and I heard him say, Amen. There were more than 3,000 people in that room from almost every country in the globe. African chiefs, Central American businessmen, people from Australia and Europe and the Middle East. And the room seemed to hum with agreement that faith and belief are the key to man's salvation and the only way we'll learn to live with each other in peace. All of you, all of the people in this room, are doing your part to fill the world with God's work and make more gentle man's life on earth. Like St. Peter and his brother St. Andrew, you've been good and faithful fishermen, and you fought the good fight for prayer in the schools and against abortion and for freedom in the world. You know perhaps better than I that you have never let us down. And I'm not shy today about asking you for your continued support in many areas, including our economic program. It occurs to me that the doctrine of election means one thing to some of you and quite another to those of us who hold public office. When I was reelected in November, I didn't figure I was being sent back to the White House to turn back to the policies of the past.
Amen.
I still believe the government is the servant of the people and not the other way around.
Amen.
We're trying to get government spending down, to hold down the huge cost of government, to keep it from taking the money you deserve to keep for your family and your future, and for God's work. We mean to ensure greater possibility for the production of wealth by lowering tax rates through tax reform. We mean to maintain a strong defense, because only with a strong defense can we preserve the peace we cherish. And I found myself wanting to remind you of what Jesus said in Luke 14:31. Or what king, when he sets out to make another king or meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, sends a delegation and asks the terms of peace. I don't think the Lord that blessed this country, as no other country has ever been blessed, intends for us to have to someday negotiate because of our weakness. But all of these things I've mentioned are pretty revolutionary. All of these things, learning to control the government, limiting the amount of money it can take from us, protecting our country through a strong defense, all of these things revolve around one word, and that word is freedom. And as Jefferson said, the Lord who gave us life, the God who gave us life, gave us liberty also. That's what we stand for here and everywhere, and that's what I need for your continued help in preserving and promoting. And every voice counts. These are crucial days ahead of us in terms of the budget and taxes and keeping our commitment to rebuild our defenses. I need all of you as never before, and we need him as never before. And we mustn't doubt at all that he will give us help and support and encouragement and guidance. You've given me these things time and again. And for all of this, I am truly thankful. And I thank all of you now for your wonderful warmth, I bask in this and will all the way back to the White House. God bless you all.
In choosing candidates for the two highest offices in the land, it is usually an acceptable practice. The president selects someone who will balance the ticket. And there were some of us in 1980 who thought that's what it was in 1980. Instead, if you were listening to the debates, you heard the vice president say regarding his loyalty to Mr. Reagan, "I owe the president two things. First, my judgment, and then my unswerving loyalty. He has given both." And rather than a balancing of the ticket, we've come to believe now in 1985, many of us, that he has complimented the ticket. He has... His support for the president's defense policies are identical with the positions that all of us have. His commitment during the debates to our perspective in the pro-life battle warmed our hearts indeed. His commitment to the return of voluntary prayer to our public schools has caused us to believe that George Bush, Ronald Reagan, both represent, believe, and support the same principles. And so therefore, it's a great joy and distinct honor for me to introduce to you at National Religious Broadcasters, first, my friend, and secondly, and most importantly, the Vice President of the United States. That was Freudian.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. What a treat it is to be here. And what a pleasure to be introduced by Dr. Jerry Falwell. Jerry, if you're free after the speech, there's some Supreme Court appointments that I'd like to talk to you about. You know, you can only die once. I'm sorry I'm going to miss Dr. Falwell's debate with Senator Kennedy tomorrow, but as a seasoned hand in debating liberals, I have some advice. The most important thing is, don't try to be patronizing. Now, remember that. But seriously, I am just delighted to be here, and I do think that it's one of the real strengths of this country that two people with radically different views can joust in a peaceful debate. I'm not surprised that Dr. Falwell initiated the debate, because that's the sort of things that members of the Electric Church, and certainly that he, both are always doing, reaching out across the airwaves, not just to the committed, but to every soul in range of the broadcast signal. And frankly, I'm delighted. I have my differences with Ted Kennedy, just as Dr. Falwell does, but I think it's wonderful that he is elected to participate in that discussion too. During the recent inauguration ceremonies, sitting there with Barbara on one side and the President and Nancy on the other, getting ready to place my hand on the Bible and swear to support and defend the Constitution, I began thinking of the opening words of the document, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union." And I thought of that union the founders created. First of all, it was a union of liberty and justice for all. And just as important, it was a union that formed one nation under God, a moral as well as a political union. And now, that isn't to say that it was one nation under one religion. We had and always will have many denominations, many faiths. But whatever the denomination, whatever the faith, everyone was united around one core of principles. Principles of love, of tolerance, respect for others, of decency, of reverence for a loving God whom we all acknowledged, however we conceived of him, as the creator of us all. And faith, freedom, family, neighborhood, work, these are the values that inspired our nation, values that have kept us free and strong over the years, and that gave the United States a greatness of spirit that made it as a beacon of hope for all mankind. And men and women came from all over this world to live in the bright life of American liberty, of American pluralism. And today they still are drawn to that beacon. Our newest citizens, it seems, are among those who value our freedoms the most. I stood there in Miami last year before 10,000 new citizens, and it was awful hard to keep the tears from pouring down my eyes as I saw those citizens with great pride sing the Star Spangled Banner for the first time as citizens of the greatest, freest country in the world. I wish you all could have seen it. This idea of pluralism was rooted in our very beginnings, a decent respect for the opinions of all mankind. That was the reason our forefathers gave for writing the Declaration of Independence. Decency, respect for diversity of opinions. That's what American pluralism is all about. And I don't know about you, but several years ago I was asking myself, is post-Vietnam, post-Watergate era, what's happened to our American pluralistic union? Take education as one example. I can't believe that the Founding Fathers intended that the Constitution prohibit children from opening their school day with a voluntary prayer. And I can't believe that they intended that the Constitution would prohibit measures to extend pluralism and tolerance in education. Measures like the tuition tax credit, some arguing that that is unconstitutional. I don't agree with that. And I can't believe that they intended that our Constitution permit the use of school buildings by political groups of every shade, but not by students of faith for the study of the Bible, the Word of God. And I'm glad to say, though, that with your help and with the leadership of many people right up here and out there in this audience, there recently was passed an equal access bill that has started us off in the right direction towards openness in our public schools. And finally, I can't believe the Constitution, a document founded on a firm conviction in the worth of the individual, could ever sanction the wholesale destruction of innocent human life. No, to provide the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. That's what they said they intended the Constitution to do. And what's happened? Well, I happen to believe that the Constitution still is good and true. And I believe the government it created of the people, by the people, for the people is still the best on earth. But I also believe that over the years we turned too much to the centralized federal government to solve our problems, and in the process to overly regulate our lives. The price we've paid is some measure of our own individual liberty. We talk about compassion, for example, and it's right that our national government be compassionate. But compassion at the national level is no substitute for loving our neighbor at the local level. And I believe it's time we look less to Washington and more to our states and cities and counties and towns and more beyond government, more to our churches, our communities of faith. Ultimately, we must look to our own resources, values, and moral belief, which means that we must look to God for the real and lasting hope of our personal lives. As you take to the airwaves, this is basically your message. The future is not dark and foreboding and apocalyptic if we have faith in God. We're now sitting down together at the conference table with the Soviet Union. Can we have an understanding with them? Is it possible to coexist on this planet? Is there hope for lasting peace in the world? And yes, I say there is hope. But our ultimate hope is in God, with whom nothing is impossible. In the last 4 years, I do think that we've seen a new birth of hope in this country. As family values are reinforced, as pride in country is treasured, as decency becomes more honored, you have been on the cutting edge out there by taking the message of hope and optimism across this land, by teaching, listening, caring, and some you have been involved. I've always loved the story that I'm sure every one of you have heard 1,000 times about the enthusiastic parishioner who after the sermon would be so inspired that he would jump up and yell, "Use me, Lord! Oh, use me, Lord!" The pastor called him in one Sunday after listening to this, and he said, "The Lord's decided to use you. Please have all those Sunday school benches painted, sanded down, painted, and ready by next Sunday." The guy quietly walked out. Following Sunday, the preacher wondered if the man would be back. Pleased to see the parishioner right there in the front row again. And following the stem winder of a sermon, the man jumped up, obviously moved, and shouted, "Use me, Lord! Oh, use me, Lord! But use me in an advisory capacity." Well, we don't really need any more advisors. We need more activists now. Activists to build the compassionate, strong, and hopeful America that we all desire. But if there ever was an example of preaching to the choir, this has got to be it. So I'll close with something from Corinthians. Perhaps it wouldn't be a bad idea for every one of us who stands before a microphone or a camera, every one of us in public life, to read the following New Testament words every morning. "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames but have not love, I gain nothing." I think it is precisely that love, that true caring, which has enabled the electric church to reach out to so many people and to be such a tremendous force for good over the years. Thank you all very much for letting me come. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Traveling Roadshow of the Odd Couple. Actually, we are here this morning to present to you the 1988 presidential ticket. The only question remains is who's going to be number one and who's going to be number two.
For many years, those who label themselves conservatives have attacked those who label themselves liberals, and vice versa. This is part of the strength and the beauty of America, that we can disagree and not be arrested by the police. On some occasions, these attacks have become personal, and it is at that point, I believe, that they are counterproductive. On the platform this morning, we have two men who know something about personal attack, as well as something about the heat of debate. As president of the Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell is a relatively newcomer to politics, though he has been a fast learner. After preaching for many years against clergy involvement in politics, Dr. Falwell became concerned that this lack of involvement was part of the problem and did not contribute to a solution of what he saw as advancing moral decay. Senator Edward Kennedy is from a family that has dominated American politics for 25 years. Indeed, some people believe that he would like to dominate politics as President of the United States. Don't know where they got that idea. The senator has recently returned from two well-publicized trips, one to Ethiopia, where he and his son and daughter visited refugee centers, a trip that was featured recently on the cover of People magazine, and from South Africa, where he had much to say about the system known as apartheid. What the senator and Dr. Falwell have agreed to do this morning is to talk about their differing views of the role of religion in public life, about the issues of the 80s, and about South Africa, which they have both visited. At the conclusion, questions will be asked of each man, questions which have been selected from a list submitted in advance when people learned of this event. Some of you may remember how these first two men got together. The Moral Majority computer mistakenly sent a membership card to the senator. The New York Times called and asked whether Moral Majority was going to ask for the card to be returned. Came the reply, "No, we don't believe any man is beyond redemption." The senator was subsequently invited to speak at Liberty Baptist College, where he gave an excellent address and was warmly received, as I know he will be here this morning before this group. The two dined last night at the Kennedy home following the dinner in Lynchburg at the Falwell home. Both men view this as a continuing dialogue, something they hope others in the conservative and liberal camps will emulate. Ground rules, as discussed, 15 to 20 minutes, and then questions. It's a pleasure to present the senior senator from Massachusetts, Edward Kennedy.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Cal Thomas. You made reference to the computer of the Moral Majority. I just want you to know I have my Moral Majority card here. I never leave home without it. Hope Reverend Falwell will let me keep it after this morning. I am grateful for your generous invitation and for the spirit in which you have welcomed me here today. A year and a half ago, I went to Liberty Baptist College to discuss the role of religion in public life. At a personal level, that evening and the events since then have been a remarkable time. I have been in the home of Reverend Jerry Falwell and his family, and he has been in mine. And when my nephew died, he was one of the first to call and offer his sympathy and prayers. We continue to have our disagreements, and I'm sure we always will. I do not expect to find him supporting any candidacy of mine for public office, at least not anytime soon, or to find myself endorsing many of his positions on public policy. Yet we have come to see each other not merely as opponents, but as fellow human beings who know the hopes, the tears, and the laughter of life. I believe something even more important has happened in the public arena. We have had a genuine exchange of ideas, a continuing debate about truth and tolerance in American society. We have heard from President Reagan and constitutional scholars, from Representative Jack Kemp and Governor Mario Cuomo, from nuns and from bishops, and from the evangelicals on both sides. We each have a judgment about the merits of the arguments which have been made. The debate has been intense. Feelings have heated and flared, and things have been said which were inaccurate and unfair.
But on the whole, we have had a healthy dialogue which has shattered certain stereotypes, caused people of strong views to listen to different voices, and perhaps even shed light on fundamental issues. So today, I would like to reflect on the progress of this dialogue and of the possibilities which I see not only for continued conversation, but even for common endeavor. First of all, virtually no one now maintains that religious values have no place in public life. The division is about where and how they should apply. For example, to abortion or arms control, to school prayer or the school lunch program, to tax cuts or budget cuts. The disputes center on when people and leaders of faith should speak out, not whether it is ever proper for them to speak at all. Thus, we cannot deny the Catholic bishops their right to stand for a nuclear freeze, or Christian Voice their right to speak against it, simply on the grounds that clerics belong solely in the pulpit, preaching about the unworldly things. That is an argument of convenience, a pawn in a debater's game, too quickly invoked in moments of disagreement, and happily ignored when religious leaders are on our side. But if we can agree that there is not and should not be an impassable wall between the city of God and the city of man, what test can tell us when we have trespassed the proper boundary between religion and politics? As I have said before, I believe that religious witness should not mobilize public authority to impose a view where a decision is inherently private in nature, or where people are deeply divided about whether it is. Virtually no one doubts that civil rights is a public issue or that murder is wrong. But Americans are plainly and persistently divided about whether abortion is the taking of human life, and the fiat of government cannot settle the issue as a matter of conscience or of conduct. To attempt that surely tempts a deepening civil discord, which can only threaten our capacity to live together in mutual regard as citizens of America, the tolerant. Roger Williams, the father of the Baptist Church in America, and a founder of our religious liberty, once warned, "It is impossible for any man or for all men to maintain their Christianity by the sword and maintain thereby a true Christianity." Today, the sword may be the censor's pen, or an act of Congress, or an amendment to the Constitution. But the warning is as powerful as it was three centuries ago. This standard does not seek conformity for the sake of uniformity, but unity based on respect for our diversity. It does not enjoin religion to be silent, but holds only that at times the proper role of religion is to persuade the individual conscience, not to harness the coercive power of the state. I am aware of the criticisms of this analysis, which were offered during the campaign and after Governor Cuomo's speech last year at Notre Dame. And after I spoke in 1983 and 1984, I believe the criticisms have been answered. I know that many of you do not think so. But frankly, I also suggest that on the other side, there has not been a similar effort to set a coherent standard for the relation between church and state. Depth of feeling or clarity of scriptural command cannot be the determining factor. The Bible cannot be the balance wheel of our social compact, no matter how much any of us may revere them, simply because the New Testament or the Pope say something, does not mean that it can be written into the law of a free and pluralistic nation, where tens of millions of people do not accept the authority of the Pope, or follow only the Old Testament, or believe in no Bible at all. Yet in vital respects, I am convinced that in these months we have also come closer together. We have learned a greater civility towards each other, a clearer sense that one can renounce a position without denouncing as evil or insincere the person who holds it. We have seen reaffirmations on both sides that there should be no religious test for citizenship or public office. Although it still happens, many more Christians are increasingly uncomfortable with branding candidates as ungodly or unchristian. And although it has happened in the past, it is increasingly unlikely that there will be serious opposition in the future to any presidential candidate simply because he or she happens to be a fundamentalist. Most of all, I suspect that we now have a renewed sense that there is a difference between believing that we are right and being self-righteous. Those who assume that the state is always sufficient unto itself are finding, in the words of the scholar Robert Bella, that religion continues to speak to central issues. And those who may be inclined to provide a religious answer for every secular question are finding, in the phrase of Reinhold Niebuhr, that political battles do not necessarily involve a struggle between the children of light and the children of darkness. Perhaps we have all caught some of the spirit of a recent editorial cartoon in which a voice from the heaven proclaims, "Thou shalt not use the Lord thy God like unto a political football." And if we have come this far towards at least understanding one another, perhaps we can now take another step together. Obviously, we will not soon resolve all our conflicts about church and state. But instead of belaboring them, let us look to places where perhaps we can all say that moral values are at stake, and where progress depends on both private concern and public commitment. I've been to two of those places in recent weeks. In one of them, children are starving even as we meet for breakfast. 500,000 of our fellow human beings have died of famine in Ethiopia and the Sudan. Among their best and only hopes are the international voluntary agencies, many of them church-related, that are bringing in what little food there is. And among the bravest human beings I have ever met are the individuals, many of them American missionaries who work for those agencies. I have never felt closer to the meaning of Christmas than when my children and I spent it with them on a distant, windswept African plateau. In the face of terrible suffering, against the odds, they are living out the command of the 25th chapter of Matthew to feed the hungry. 8,000 miles away, here in our own abundant land, we have the opportunity and the moral obligation to contribute to their effort. There is much we can do without government, but there is more which can be done if we challenge government itself to do more. The members of the moral majority and of the people for the American way ought to be able to join in this shared purpose, which should transcend even the most angry divisions. President Reagan has now pledged his leadership to secure whatever is required to end the famine. He deserves credit for that, and our support, yours and mine, for the legislation which will soon come before Congress. And I hope that in your efforts to advance moral values in national life, you will give the highest priority to this area where no one doubts that your witness should be heard and heeded, and where it is so urgently needed to provide the bread of life to so many desperate people, members of our single human family, half a world away. Yet, as you and my own pastors would quickly remind me, men and women do not live by bread alone. A truly human existence also depends on a broader range of human rights, on the recognition that we are each, regardless of our country or our color, created in the image and likeness of God. The second place I visited recently was South Africa, which systematically deprives people of that fundamental dignity. Most whites, like most blacks in that nation, claim to be devoutly Christian, but Jesus himself, who conceivably could be classified by the rules of apartheid as colored or as Asian, could not sit in the separate pews of many of the churches where he is worshipped each and every Sunday. Yet it is also from churches in South Africa that the movement for racial justice has sprung. The movement flourishes under the leadership of Bishop Desmond Tutu, the Nobel laureate for peace, the Reverend Alan Bosack, the president of the World Council of Dutch Reformed Churches, and the Reverend Bayers Naudé, a white Africana who years ago put aside the temptation of privilege in the ruling establishment in order to fulfill a higher and harder calling, which is to speak truth to power. Their commitment calls to us as well, for it is as old as the ancient words of God through Moses to the Pharaoh of Egypt, "Let my people go." And if anyone doubts that this is a moral issue, I reply, let them go as I did to the bleak hostels outside of Johannesburg, where workers are forced to dwell hundreds of miles from home for 11 months of every year. Apartheid leaves them with a grim choice between supporting their families and living with their families. Apartheid will not permit a wife or daughter to say, as Ruth said to Naomi, "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Aught but death part thee and me." There is no clearer pro-family issue in the world today than opposing the South African law, which brings a kind of death to family life. Rights are taken which are as fundamental as the most basic humanity, and as fresh as a newborn child. The right of sons and daughters to grow up with their parents. The right of man and wife to be together. The right to make a home for those we love. And if anyone doubts that South Africa involves a moral issue, let them go as I have to the arid, treeless resettlement camp of Anverwacht, where a quarter of a million blacks have been compelled to move since 1981. The most vivid, searing memory I carried with me from there was of a sandy graveyard filled to overflowing with the bodies of young children, and a government official who was in charge of the camp but did not even know the rate of infant mortality. And if anyone doubts that this is a moral issue, let them justify a system founded on racism with liberty for a minority and oppression, torture, and injustice for the vast majority of its people. South Africa is the last place on earth that clings to the illusion of a master race. Some argue that we dare not resist this regime because it, for all of its evils, is a bulwark against communism. But we cannot oppose tyranny by imitating its tactics. When we try, those who fight fire with fire may find themselves finally caught in the flames. Those who profess anti-communism cannot support a regime which treats its own unions as the communists have mistreated Solidarity in Poland. They cannot abide influx control and the banning of dissidents in South Africa and then assail the internal passports and the exile of Andrei Sakharov in the Soviet Union. And when I hear apologists for apartheid suggest that we could lose South Africa, I answer that we already are. We now face an ominous and increasing risk that a whole new generation of black South Africans will look, not to the United States, but elsewhere for their inspiration. Some of them are now filled with hostility toward America. I reject now, as I did while I was in South Africa, their simplistic Marxist slogans. As I said at the time when I saw their sign saying, "What about the Vietnam War?" which I vigorously opposed, I felt like taking those signs and turning them over and writing on them, "What about Poland? What about Afghanistan?" But at the same time, we must not ignore the danger, the alienation, and the polarization emerging in South Africa. So it is that we must all try, which was one of the reasons for my journey, to send the message that America stands for freedom in that country. And the people in every American city who care about this issue are proving by their protests that the 1980s need not be a decade of indifference, a time of lonely hopes and narrow horizons. They are demonstrating, as so many have in South Africa, that individuals are still ready to respond when they are challenged, to stand up not only for themselves, but for others, not only for their interests, but for their ideals.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the cassette over for the continuation of this tape.
Conservative Republicans Congress have joined the call to separate America, step by step, from any complicity with apartheid. You and your churches can make a difference by refusing to hold investments in South Africa and by rallying to the bipartisan bill to bring escalating pressure for change. My request for your involvement not only relates to South Africa, it reaches wherever oppressed men and women yearn to breathe free. in so many places for so many anguished years. So many of them have kept the faith that they too shall overcome. At times it must be seen that all the lights are snuffed out and an impenetrable night descends. Yet there is a spark that passes from person to person, from generation to generation, soaring across barren miles and barbed wire, barriers of language and experience. In its passage, that spark warms the spirit of a political prisoner in a cold cell in South Africa, and it links him with others far away in the jails of Chile, Kampuchea, and the Gulag Archipelago. It is the one eternal flame that burns in the hearts of men and women everywhere, the light of liberty that will flash someday across each land and the entire earth. As Pope John Paul II has written, the light that lingered in ordinary things, like a spark sheltered under the skin of our days, the light was you. Those brave and daring individuals who in our day, under the most difficult circumstances, sustain the spark of faith that we are all the children of God. They are the light of our time and a shining beacon to us. Their example beckons us to their side, to the cause of our most decent and human values, to the second great commandment, to love one another. As I said at the outset, we may debate how to serve that cause, when government should be involved, and when it should stand aside. And the dialogue of the past months have focused on that debate. Surely, we will each hold to our views, because clearly we believe that they are right. But can we also move beyond defining our differences to finding common ground, where we are in accord, Republicans and Democrats, whatever our faith, let us stand together to make our most precious shared ideals come true. We must do this because it too is right, not for our own sake, not even because we care about each other, but because we care for the human beings who are our brothers and sisters. From my earliest years, I was taught by my parents and by my own brothers and sisters to honor that obligation. From my family, I learned the power and the sustenance of faith. As a child, my mother often quoted to me these words of Tennyson, "More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of." So my purpose here today, my prayer for each of us and all our country, is that in the ways we did not even dream only a short while ago, we shall work together. And by that grace, the good works of peace and justice shall be wrought more fully in all the world. Thank you. Last night, the regional chapter of the Moral Majority met at Senator Kennedy's home and appointed and anointed him as local chairman. And we had the advantage of the fact that his mother is a fundamentalist in a lot of ways, in a lot of ways. So he had a little experience with us. You know, I was in this room just the other night when the senator's name was taken in vain. I was here when the Washington Press Club was honoring the Congress, and as John Riggins slept, and John D. Rockefeller IV was, as a freshman senator from West Virginia, being roasted, and he came to the flat platform telling about the terrible experience of moving here, looking for property. And he said, you wouldn't believe the prices, that only a Kennedy could afford this kind of land. And finally he said, you know, you'd never believe what they want for the Ellipse. And but his wife had decided never to let him run for president because she didn't want to move into a smaller house. I know the senator had to feel, walking into this group, much like Daniel did walking into the lion's den, and much like I did walking into Harvard. But I agree, I concur with what the senator has said here this morning, that we have one very basic common denominator that equates every one of us, and that is we are free-born Americans,
and we are charged with the responsibility of keeping this the bastion of freedom at any price for our children's and children's children's sake. And Senator, thank you for coming here today very, very much. America enters the second half of the 1980s, a period some have properly called a decade of destiny, faced with some very crucial and complicated issues, problems that we no longer can ignore or allow to go unsolved. We have an overwhelming and spiraling deficit caused by 50 years of New Deals and bad deals and great societies and sick societies, and a prevailing philosophy within both major political parties that we can eventually spend ourselves out of debt. And if Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill are successful in solving this dilemma, it is very good that neither of them is planning to run again for public office, because neither of them would be reelectable. Some very unpopular things must be done by necessity. The nuclear arms race is about to finish its last lap in what has been, in the opinion of many, a 40-year marathon towards universal annihilation. Fortunately, because of the strong leadership of President Reagan during the past 4 years, the Soviets have now come back to the negotiating table, and we have hope that at least the beginnings of meaningful and verifiable arms reductions may be achieved in the near future. And also, fortunately, in my opinion, thanks again to Ronald Reagan, we will be dealing with the Soviets from a position of strength, the only position, the only language the Soviets seem to respect and understand. Central America poses another serious problem for this country. Nicaragua is gone, and regardless what you may think of the Marxist-Leninists, they do very well at keeping what they steal. El Salvador is tottering, and if many members of the Congress who are refusing to support President Reagan's efforts to help our neighbors in the South to defend themselves, if they're successful, all of Central America may possibly go down. Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, Belize, Panama, and I think the plum of Latin America, Mexico, with its gas and oil fields, all of these may very well fall into the malignant grip of Soviet-Cuban expansionism. It is something we cannot ignore, and we must understand that we can no longer in this real world be isolationist and have one little island of freedom here within our own borders. And if the boat people of Southeast Asia presented and are continuing to present a major problem socially, economically, politically for the international community, it is my opinion that if Central America falls, the problem of boat people will be a minuscule one compared to the feet people. Multi-millions of Latin Americans will be crossing our southern borders into the United States. And for that reason, I think we should be supporting unswervingly the administration's efforts to provide military and economic aid to our friends south of the border. Our American boys are not needed. Our resources are needed. And then we're facing moral and social issues, which, in my opinion, as a Bible-believing and born-again Christian, pose even greater danger for our beloved homeland than the deficit, the nuclear arms race, or the Central American problem. It is my conviction that we have far more as a nation to fear from the wrath of an almighty God who is angry with us for the destruction of 15 million innocent, unborn children during the past 12 years than we have to fear from the Soviet Union. And while we as Christians deplore all acts of violence, and particularly clinic bombings, as criminal activities and as detrimental to the cause of the liberation of the unborn, we must not allow these bombings to divert attention away from the violence and the ultimate acts of child abuse now being performed inside those clinics 4,000 times a day, every day. And we must continue pressing the battle for judicial and legislative reform We must continue to curse the darkness, but along with cursing the darkness, we must also light some candles. We must put our money where our mouths are. The pro-life movement has not always been good at that. We've been famous for what we're against. We have not provided the alternatives. And the time has come when we must establish enough save-a-baby centers and full-service maternity residence centers and homes and adoption agencies and crisis pregnancy centers in this country to accommodate the 1.5 million women who are now having legal abortions in this country, who, when the court finally rules, and I feel they will, no longer will be able to have legal abortions. We should give thanks to God that the momentum is finally moving in our favor. Judy Goldsmith agrees to that. President Reagan has said that. And so has Newsweek magazine and ABC 2020. In recent days, we've become aware that public opinion, for example, in Newsweek, for the first time, a majority, 58% of Americans, indicated they want some kind of legislation to at least curb convenience abortions. I think that's encouraging. I think education is the answer. Patient and persistent presentation of the facts. Men like Dr. Bernard Nathanson and others who are, from a scientific perspective, producing films like The Silent Screen. This is our hope for the future, and we must press on and on and on, along with that, developing all of the necessary mechanics and the structure in this country to account for and to accommodate the women who will need a loving alternative. And also in the next 4 years, we have high hopes that our president will be appointing several more persons to the Supreme Court. And if, like Sandra Day O'Connor, they are as philosophically compatible with the position of the president on the life issue, we can expect a pro-life court by 1988. And to clear up the vice president's comment yesterday with the press, it'll be President Reagan, not Jerry Falwell, who'll be doing that. I, in addition, believe that before we can convince the Supreme Court that our position is valid, we must be ready when they ask us the question on that day when Roe v. Wade is either being reversed or modified, when they ask the question, who is going to prevent the development of an underground underworld abortion industry, back alley, kitchen table abortions, we must be able to say loud and clear, your honors, now in place in this country because of the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, are adequate facilities, proper facilities, without charge to every person who needs an alternative to abortion. And when we have done that, we will earn the right to pick up our newspaper wherever we live and read that wonderful headline, abortion outlawed in the United States. I was criticized for a statement I made on ABC's 2020 program with Barbara Walters 2 weeks ago when I said I'm willing to accept a legislation or a judicial action that will allow for abortions in the case of rape, incest, and where the life of the mother is threatened. I want to explain that position. I do not theologically believe that rape and incest are viable exceptions for abortion. I shall always preach and reach out for those girls who are victims thusly. But I also do not believe we'll ever have legislation that does not allow for those exceptions. And since over 99% of all abortions are convenience abortions and are not as a result of rape and incest, then I am willing to save 1.4 million of those who are being destroyed in this country now, and then through our loving Christian ministry, reach out to do everything we can to save the other 1%. I often use the analogy of the hijacker who has commandeered an airliner filled with men, women, and children. A negotiator achieves or procures from that hijacker an agreement to release the women and children. If he's wise, he will not say no, all or nothing. He'll take those women and children and then work to get the men off later. And that is, I think, got to be the reasonable position of those of us in the pro-life movement as we move towards putting to an end this biological holocaust in our country. Last year, there were 5 million families who expressed a desire to adopt a child. If all 1.5 million children who were aborted had, in fact, been offered the option of life and been put up for adoption, we still would have had a deficit of 3.5 million babies. So there's no lack of homes and love and money. And by the way, there's not a minority problem, as some try to paint it. 71% of all abortions are children who are white. And so the problem is universal sin. And the cure and the hope is the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ. And may we join hands together in these next few years to put an end to it. Senator Kennedy spent some time discussing his trip to Africa, the Republic of South Africa, the region of East Africa, which includes Ethiopia, Sudan, Kenya, and other impoverished nations. Last night, my wife and I commented after going to bed, we were so moved as young Teddy, who's one of the finest skiers on one leg in the country, led the prayer to Kennedy home and told of his own experience there of physically involving himself in volunteer help. And he said, you know, the thing, Reverend, that so impressed me was that one person can make a difference. And I wish all of you could have heard the prayer. And we just left there. We fell in love with young Teddy. Now, not that we don't love you, Senator, but that young man, Teddy Kennedy, is something special. First, let me comment on South Africa. Like Senator Kennedy, I, too, have been there, only briefly, and I've been there twice, less than a week in the region, so I'm therefore not an expert, and I'm sure the Senator doesn't consider himself to be one. But we have both been observers from a distance. I've also observed those politicians and civil rights workers who have demonstrated outside the South African embassy. I've heard the orchestrated comments all over the nation and the world that have been given to the media regarding this horrible and terrible South Africa. I've heard the demands that the business community disinvest South Africa. And even some have gone so far as to recommend a break of diplomatic relations with that republic. I too believe, and I suspect that everyone in this room agrees with the Senator, that apartheid is abominable. The word apartheid means the word apartheid means in English apartness. That's our ugly word, segregation. This is wrong, must be repealed, it must be changed. But it's important to note that in the past few years, some major changes have occurred in South Africa. They haven't come far enough, nor have we. But today, restaurants, shops, general commerce have been open to blacks. Coloreds and Asians were given the right to vote last year. And although blacks cannot vote in general elections in the Republic of South Africa, they do vote in their own particular homelands. Less than 25 million persons live in that country. 5 million are white. The white are composed of English or British, Dutch or Afrikaners, plus Greeks, French, Jews, and Portuguese. And then there are 1.5 million coloreds. The coloreds are the mixed black and white. They live mainly in Cape Province, and they're mostly Christian. And then there are 2 million Asians. These include Indians from the nation of India, who are primarily Hindus, Malays, who are Muslims, and Chinese, who are Buddhist. And then there are 15 million blacks. And among these blacks are many tribes, probably over 80 tribes, and with all different, each having different languages. The Zulu tribe is the largest, and then there are the Sotho, the Venda, the Xhosa, the Tswana, the Swazi, etc., so many of them. And further, there are two black homelands within South Africa, namely Swaziland and Lesotho, that have been recognized by the UN. Others that have not been recognized, such as Zululand, Transkei, Venda, and others. The whites first arrived there in 1652. That's more than 300 years ago. And they no more intend to give up their country than we plan to give ours back to the Indians. The British eventually took Cape Province and Natal. The Dutch took Transvaal and Orange Free State. The Union of South Africa was formed in 1610, but the modern Republic of South Africa was formed in 1961, meaning that the current government, the current Republic of South Africa, is less than 25 years old. A very young nation indeed. Now, it's important, if we're going to be fair and point the finger of blame at South Africa for their bad civil rights record, to remember that from 1776, the year that our country was born, to 1861, when we fought a war, an internal war over slavery, 85 years transpired. And now, since that war, 100 years later, our generation continues to fight for the civil rights of minorities in this country. What I'm saying is this. While South Africa has a long way to go, they have progressed and done far better than the United States of America has done with her problem, and they don't need our hypocritical condemnation. They need our coercive and patient encouragement to clean up their act while at the same time not passing them over to the Soviets. It very much is possible to go into certain areas of South Africa and take photographs of poverty and squalor. This is indefensible. It's necessary to say that you can go into every nation in Africa and find even worse scenes. You can go into the inner cities of the United States and find similar and pitiful conditions. This is unacceptable. But there's some very good things to be said about South Africa as well, and very few are saying them. One, in South Africa today, the literacy rate is above 80%. In the rest of Africa, less than 10%. Presently, thousands of blacks are immigrating into South Africa. Some have estimated as many as 750,000 a year, while none are leaving, and they have permission to do so. So the problem in South Africa is not quite so simple a black and white issue as we Americans like to frame it. I believe that President Reagan is very wise in suggesting constructive engagement, which simply means that to continue working patiently with the South African government is the best policy for all persons in South Africa. He does not believe that force or disinvestment are the answers. And those who are suggesting disinvestment are ignoring the fact that this would immediately unemploy 150,000 blacks in that country who work for American companies, and this would help no one. One man, one vote, of course, is the ideal. We believe in that in this country. It works for us. Most of us have said that if 100% of all eligible voters ever voted, and they don't, in a national election, every one of us could live with what 51% decided. That doesn't happen, unfortunately. But one man, one vote in Africa often means, almost always means, one man, one vote, one time. And all one need do is look across the borders of the Republic of South Africa to our neighbors to prove that point. Mozambique is now a communist country. It was formerly Portuguese. And the Mozambican government recently closed every church in the land. They're now bankrupt. Electricity and food supplies are low. And so, out of necessity, they recently signed peace accords with South Africa in order to get the food and supplies to survive. Angola is another neighbor of South Africa. It is also communistic, controlled by the Russians and the beloved Cubans. They're very hostile to South Africa. Why? Because South Africa is the only reason that they cannot take over Southwest Africa or Namibia as we know it, and thus confiscate all of her diamonds, uranium, and minerals that the whole free world needs so badly. And then there's South Africa's immediate neighbor to the north, Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia. Communist leader Robert Mugabe rules that country. He's from the Shona tribe. His government persecutes all minority tribes, and especially the Indibele tribe of Joshua Nkomo, his competitor for the throne there. Half the whites have left since 1981. They're in terrible economic condition, and obviously they have no relations with South Africa. And in none of these communist countries do they have free elections. And in none of these communist countries do they have civil rights for any of their citizens, black, white, or otherwise. A key point then at this moment would be to ask if the black tribes in South Africa voted today and took control of that nation, which tribe would ultimately rule? Because at the moment the tribes are hostile towards each other. South African government troops must prevent constant civil war between those tribes. And if the Zulu tribe, the largest, should, as the Shona tribe in Zimbabwe, take control of the country, not only would the Asians, the coloreds, and the whites be in serious trouble, but so would all of the minority black tribes. This is a matter of fact, and anyone who has studied history in that area knows that to be true. I repeat that the ultimate goal in South Africa must be absolute equality. But we must not, like the moral policemen of the world, attempt to force South Africa into a position that would do nothing more than hand this very strategic and friendly nation over to the Soviet Union. We seem to have a talent in doing that. We've been hurting our friends for a long time. And I would like to ask the question of some of those who demonstrate outside the South African embassy. Why don't you demonstrate against Zimbabwe? Why not outside the Soviet embassy, where We have a repressive regime that is persecuting Christians and Jews today. And not only persecuting Christians and Jews, but harassing and persecuting the Poles and the Afghans and the East Europeans. As a matter of fact, all 275 million citizens inside the Soviet Union are really inmates in one mammoth concentration camp, unable to move from city to city without permission from the government, unable to work where they please without governmental permission. That is slavery. And I would suggest to those in the orchestrated demonstrations, move up to the Soviet embassy. What about the Cuban embassy because of their intervention in Angola and Latin America? What about Red China, where they go into villages, gather up the pregnant women, and give them forced abortions? And on the list goes. What I'm saying is, we have so many problems of our own when we look at the American Indian and what we've done to them. When we look at our own difficulties in the state of Virginia, we have about as many black representatives in the Congress as there are in Massachusetts. And the judiciary has the same problem. And all across this country, and while we must coerce and use our influence to help South Africa to get in line, we don't need to be hypocrites about it and ignore the fact that the worst crimes against civil rights are occurring in communist lands. Ethiopia, East Africa. We can certainly blame the drought and the expanding desert for that horrible, horrible drought and problem of starvation. But we can also place some blame on Marxist governments in the region, like that one in Addis Ababa, that will not allow food to be taken to those northern tribes because they consider them to be rebels while warehouses are filled. You know, socialism is nothing but mutually shared poverty. And wherever socialism has gotten its grips on a land and Marxism is its philosophy, starvation usually follows. The Soviet Union is the pride and joy of the Marxist movement. Yet it's bankrupt. Their people are hungry. A large percentage of their people are farmers and cannot feed themselves. 5% of the American people in free enterprise are farmers and are feeding much of the world. In summary, we must sincerely and patiently use all of our leverage to help South Africa come to where we are as far as civil rights are concerned, but at the same time attempt to improve our own blemished record. And we must remember that South Africa is a friend, like Israel is a friend. And lately we've been kicking both of them in the teeth. If it were not for Israel in the Mideast and South Africa on that continent, right now the oil fields and minerals of both areas would belong to the Soviet Union, and what a mess we would be in indeed. All we need do is look at some recent trades we've made to see how foolish we've been. We traded our friend, the Shah, for that sweet, loving, amicable Ayatollah. We traded our friend Somoza for the Marxist Sandinistas. And if some persons in America had their way, we would trade the government in Jerusalem, a democracy, for Gaddafi, and the government in Pretoria for the Kremlin. Now, admittedly, the Shah and Somoza and some of these fellows with whom we've had good relations are far but desirable fellows. We, as a matter of fact, might admit that some of them have been skunks. But if we must do business with skunks, and sometimes we must, I prefer the one who's spraying in the other direction. And in the hills of Virginia, we call that common sense. In summary, the world is in turmoil. And we who believe in the gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and who have accepted the claims of his death, burial, and resurrection as the full atonement for our salvation, we have an obligation. We are our brother's keeper. We must build mercy camps and bases, as Liberty Baptist College is planning to do right now in Northeast Sudan, joining with great movements like World Vision and Food for the Hungry and hundreds like them. But at the same time, we must realize there are no quick fixes and no simple solutions. It is a long, long road, and the real and permanent answer, while we work and plan for the benefit of the next generation, the real hope we have in our breast is that there's a God in heaven who loves us more than we love ourselves and who rules in the affairs of men, as Ben Franklin said. And as we look to him, trust in him, pray and work and negotiate for peace, I believe that we can be optimistic about America, about the world, about our children. And very frankly, I fully expect that we'll pass on to our children a greater America and a greater free world than our parents passed on to us. God bless you. Will you be seated, please? We've appreciated very much having these comments, these messages by the Senator and by Dr. Falwell. As could have been predicted, when a senator and a preacher get going, there's no time for questions. Although I will ask a question of each. Senator, yours has been a family filled with much tragedy. How have you been able to cope and to sustain yourself in the midst of all that has happened?
Well, I grew up in a family and where faith and prayer was extremely important and a vital part of our family life. And I can think of the times of great difficulty and challenge and sadness, the first time when I lost my brother in World War II, and where I was so conscious of a family being together and believing in a future life, and what a source of strength that was. I can remember other times, loss of family members, my brother Jack in 1963, and returning up to be with my father at that time, who was crippled and from a heart attack, and came up in Cape Cod. And I remember praying with him that evening, saying the rosary. And I can remember, before going to bed, opening the Bible and reading Corinthians. It says, death, where is thy victory? Death, where is thy sting? Prayer and family have been the source of inspiration in dealing with some of the great challenges in my life, as I'm sure in many others.
Dr. Falwell, is there one thing that you have learned as a result of your relationship with Senator Kennedy that you could share with us?
I've learned a lot. I've learned these liberals are smart.
And very articulate. Yes, seriously, I've learned. And I hope all of us are in the process of forever learning and growing, that nothing is accomplished until we move out of the screaming stage into the civil discussion. And I think that is where we are coming, and that is where this group will make its greatest contribution in the future. Not bombing clinics, not calling names, but prayerfully and intelligently debating facts. And I think we owe a lot of that instruction and information and example to the Senator Kennedys of our day who have been doing it that way for a long time. Senator, if there's any one thing you'd change about Jerry Falwell, what would it be?
How much time do we have here? I think Reverend Falwell works too hard. I'd suggest that he take a sabbatical in 1988.
Jerry, do you want to comment on that same question, just the reverse? On that question, what would you change about the senator?
Oh, yeah.
I think the senator would make a great, great Republican Baptist. Let's thank them a great deal.